approve the claims for today, and for the year 2001, 99-1119, National Operating LP versus Mutual Life Insurance Company of New York. And our first counsel is Mark Foley, representing National Operating. Foley.
If it please the court, I am Mark Foley. I'm with the law firm of Foley and Lardner, and with me here today is my colleague David Simon, who assisted me on the briefing this matter. We are representing the petitioner, plaintiff, appellant, National Operating LP, which we'll refer to periodically as National or NOLP. We'll refer to Mutual of New York as Money and Bridgeview Plaza Partners as Bridgeview. I believe that there are three factors which set the context of this case and which will determine the outcome. The first is that this case arises upon National Operating's motion for partial summary judgment on its claims that it is entitled to prevent a commercially unreasonable disposition of its collateral, which secured a debt of money, to receive any amount in excess of its debt, which money might collect upon liquidation of the collateral, and for an accounting of amounts received and applied to the debt. The only defense raised against this motion for partial summary judgment in the trial court was the claim of res judicata, a claim preclusion arising out of a declaratory judgment action brought previously by money would prevent us from raising any of these claims in the first instance. Without this defense, if money loses on this defense, National Operating is entitled to the partial summary judgment it sought in its claims in the lower court. The second factor is that it's important to realize that National Operating here seeks the application of settled law to long-recognized forms of commercial transactions. In contrast, money seeks to reinterpret and broaden existing law in a manner inconsistent with past precedent and policy to accomplish a result contrary to the long-established commercial law and policies of this state and its statutes, as well as the party's undisputed intent, all in order to save for itself a multi-million-dollar windfall to recover and keep money it was not owed. Third, this case arises out of an assignment of a wrap note and mortgage as collateral. That means this case is governed by the Wisconsin Commercial Code, the state's version of the Uniform Commercial Code, and specifically Article 9.
Who drafted the assignment?
The assignment was drafted primarily by Mutual of New York. The particular clause which is at issue in this case, namely the right to obtain a reconveyance of the wrap note and mortgage upon payment of the underlying debt, was requested by counsel for our client upon his review of the documents. There is evidence in the record that he proposed language. I believe there were some modifications made to it by money, and it was ultimately accepted by both parties.
Let me ask you about 409 since you brought it up. Now, assuming that we know what was pleaded in the declaratory judgment, there wasn't any mention, obviously, of 409. Is 409 independent at all times of whatever documentation or draftsmanship there is? In other words, it seems to, I think you made the argument it's not waivable. In other words, you can't change things. And assuming your opposing counsel will be also discussing this, why isn't it extinguished by the 1996 declaratory judgment?
Okay. To answer your question as it was broadly asked, does Chapter 409 ever permit modification by the terms of the agreement? Yes, it certainly does. But there are some things which it does not permit modification of. And three of those, are the right to insist upon a commercially reasonable disposition of the collateral. It has to be reasonable in all regards. The statute demands it. Second, to account for any excess proceeds is not waivable. That is both by the terms of the statute, by the history of the Uniform Commercial Code and its developers, particularly Grant Gilmore, and third, by prior case law of this state.
So does that mean it goes on forever? I mean, there's no cutoff? I mean, would it be commercially reasonable? Let's say you continued for the next 10 years, or they let's say the other side debt money, and then they came in, and then you would say, hey, we're still out here, and we want to take a look at this, we've got our 409 rights. So in other words, it just keeps on going?
Two answers to that question. One is, the reason I said a really important contextual matter here was the fact that this was the assignment of a wrap note and mortgage, is that this is a kind of commercial transaction that was created, I think, in the 1980s or 1970s, but for the express purpose of permitting the initial purchaser, NOLP in this case, and the issuer of the mortgagee of the wrap mortgage, to take advantage of changes in the value of the real estate. That's exactly what it was intended to do as a device. So yes, it's intended to permit it to take advantage of increasing values of the property.
If the market goes up, you take advantage. If it goes down, you scoot and you are never heard from again.
Depending on the terms of the agreement, that's possible. But in this context, where we are talking about this wrap note and mortgage having been assigned as collateral, Mutual of New York is in the position of a secured creditor. It came in and got the right, confirmed the right that it had under the documents to take possession of its collateral and to liquidate it, or to exercise rights under it. If it chose to do that right away, if it held a commercially reasonable sale of the collateral right away and paid over any excess amounts, or if there weren't any, paid over nothing, that would be the end of the matter. But the fact is it didn't do anything for 3 years. It got the right to take possession, to exercise rights as primary payee and mortgagee, so that the payments that Bridgeview would have been making to National Operating instead were coming and being applied to National Operating's debt, to money. That, again, was the whole idea of assigning this as collateral. The stream of payments were being applied. It was only 3 years later where Mutual of New York decided that it was going to, in effect, sell the collateral, liquidate the collateral, by forgiving the balance of the Bridgeview debt, canceling the mortgage, and taking a $4 million payment, that the liquidation of collateral event occurred.
Well, when would default occur, the second default?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't know what you mean by the second default.
Well, I guess I just don't understand this agreement.
Okay.
And let me go back and start. It's the last three paragraphs which are key.
All right.
Okay, the first of those last three paragraphs says that National is assigning to Mutual of New York all of its right, title, and interest, right?
Yes.
Okay, so they are assigning the right, title, and but what rights do they have? The right to collect money, is that it?
They are the payee under the note,
okay,
so they have the right to collect money.
So money's going to, from the future, from now on, assigning this note, they're going to collect the money.
No. That only happens if there is a default. See, again, you have to understand the context. This is a security arrangement. This is not an outright sale of this note. This is an assignment of the note as collateral. It is undisputed in this record from the depositions of the lending officer and the business people that this was a security transaction. This was the giving of additional collateral, additional security to money.
Yeah, I don't understand, counsel, because it says assignor, which is national, hereby assigns to MONY all of its right, title, and interest. Now, I mean, that sounds pretty like the end of the world to me, that the national is getting rid of everything.
Except, Your Honor, if I can find the quotation from Chapter 409. Chapter 409 of the Wisconsin Commercial Code says, I'm going to have a little trouble finding it. It says that this chapter,
secured transactions
chapter, applies to any transaction, whether it's denominated, and there's a whole list of things, one of which is assignment, which is intended as security for a debt. The undisputed record here is that this assignment was intended as security for the debt. This is actually a fairly common way of engaging in one of these transactions.
So you're saying, although it says that it's assigning its right, title, and interest, it's not really doing that.
It is not doing that until such time as a default is declared.
Okay.
and the secured creditor exercises its rights as secured creditor.
Then I get back to my next question. What was the default here that put this into operation?
The default that put this into operation is that there was a loan extension agreement which in effect extended the due date on the note that was owed from National Operating to Money. That date arrived. Mutual of New York said, pay us. National Operating said, the note from Bridgeview isn't due yet, so we can't make them pay us. We don't have enough independent sources of funds. The market has gone crazy, and we can't get new financing at this point in time, so we can't pay you. Mutual of New York says, okay, if you can't pay us, here's a letter saying that we're going to exercise our rights as secured creditor to step into your shoes as the payee under Bridgeview. Why? Because the amount of payments under the Bridgeview note were greater than the payments due from National Operating to Money under the underlying note. That's the whole point of the wrap arrangement.
I understand that, counsel, and I appreciate that because I understand it a little clearer now. But then it seems to me, now going to paragraph 3, you seem to be saying, at least your argument seems to be saying, that paragraph 3 had nothing to do with this default and that you could continue to exercise this reconveyance at any time after default. And what I'm saying, I don't understand that, because your right to get that reconveyance, I would think, has to end sometime. Are you saying that this whole, that Bridgeview could have ended up paying everything to MONY and nobody was making payments anymore, and then all of a sudden in the year 2010 you come in and say, hey, reconvey to me?
With all due respect, Your Honor, that's a red herring which my opponents have thrown out here. We have never said this would go on forever.
Well, how long does it go on?
It goes on until the collateral is liquidated. It goes on until the secured creditor exercises its rights to realize upon its collateral. Once it has done that in a commercially reasonable manner that we can't attack on other grounds, once it has accounted for the proceeds, we're done.
I guess I don't understand that.
Because, Your Honor, that is the nature.
Chinese to me.
Okay, that is the nature of the security transaction. We owe you a debt. We pledge collateral to you. If we don't pay the debt, you can take that collateral. You can exercise our rights in it. You can sell it. Okay? In this particular case, the collateral had a lot of different attributes. One was a stream of payments coming from Bridgeview. Okay? What Money chose to do for 3 years was to accept that stream of payments and apply it to the debt that Money was owed by National Operating. They could have at any time exercised National Operating's right as the holder of the mortgage and simply foreclosed the property, had a sheriff's sale. That would have been the end of it. They didn't choose to do that until 1998, when they in effect had a private sale of the collateral to Bridgeview. They said, Bridgeview, pay us $4 million, you can have it.
Well, what if, in a hypothetical, what if National had not fortuitously found out about this deal and the sale had gone through? Now, could you continue to exercise your rights under that third paragraph?
I think we would have rights to notice on the disposition of our collateral under state law. So if they didn't give that notice, then I believe that the sale would be subject to attack.
Well, do you believe that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Foley, let me ask you not about the assignment, but about the declaratory judgment.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm looking at at page 7 of the declaratory judgment. It indicates it is ordered, adjudged, and decreed, and then dropping down, indicates extinguishing the rights of the defendant, National Operating LP, as a mortgagee under said mortgage. Further extinguishing the rights of National Operating LP as payee under the note, and then it goes on confirming LaSalle National Bank as the trustee.
Yes, sir.
What do those phrases mean in that declaratory judgment if they don't directly affect what you're now claiming?
As we tried to explain in one of the footnotes in our brief, there is a problem with this kind of transaction in the real world, and that is, if you are Bridgeview and you have a mortgage and a note that says, make payments to me, National Operating, and you're making those payments, and all of a sudden, Mutual of New York, who you don't know has any interest in this at all, shows up one day and says, pay us instead. You as the tenant have a problem. You don't know who to give the money to. And the law says that it's the tenant's problem, that if they make the payment to the wrong party, they don't get credit for it, and so they've got to figure it out. So what typically happens in these circumstances is that the lender in money's position will come into court and get a declaratory judgment so that there is no dispute anymore. There's no possibility of a dispute as to who's supposed to get the money. And that's what they did here. They got a judgment telling Bridgeview, pay us the money because we have exercised our rights to step into the shoes of National Operating as payee and mortgagee. What it doesn't say, Your Honor, is it does not say that the rights of National Operating as pledgor and assignor under the assignment are extinguished. It does not say that National Operating's rights under the loan extension agreement are extinguished. It does not say its rights under Article 9 are extinguished. All it says is that its rights as primary payee and primary mortgagee.
And that's only because you were...
I don't... If I can interrupt you there, I don't see where it says primary.
If I could ask my...
It seems to be very broad, extinguishing the rights of the defendant as mortgagee under the mortgage, extinguishing the rights of National Operating as payee under the note. National Operating was a party to this declaratory judgment action, and I don't see where it says anything at all about primary.
On page 5, the declaratory judgment itself says, as payee under the note, confirming the plaintiff's interest as primary mortgagee and holder of the note and mortgage declared herein. That was the language I was referring to.
Well, I'm looking at the judgment itself.
On page 7. This is
where, right after...
This is the demand for judgment. The point is the same, Your Honor. What was confirmed was their right to act as mortgagee and payee. This is a declaratory judgment. That's the only thing they asked for, and so that's the only thing that's determined. The primary mortgagee and holder language is also on page 8, the next page at the top of the page, Your Honor. It's part of the judgment. So,
well, this language that Justice Crooks is quoting from, wasn't this... Isn't that language just a mirror of what the relief was requested?
Absolutely. Money wrote the complaint. Money wrote the findings of fact and conclusions of judgment. Money drafted the judgment.
And Money gave
judgment.
That, and your client had notice of what that language was.
I don't know that, Your Honor. I don't know, we stand here, whether that was ever sent to my client.
Right.
I don't have any recollection that it was. I can't represent to the court for certain that it wasn't. I would have to check that fact.
I think I read somewhere in the record.
They had notice of the litigation. They knew the lawsuit.
They had notice of litigation.
I don't know that they had notice of the exact language of the judgment before it was entered.
Well, now looking back on it, I guess hindsight, but...
I don't know that it would have made any difference.
Drafted that language, counsel, would you maybe have drafted it a little bit differently?
I think that depends, Your Honor, on whether I knew there was another potential dispute at the time. Because, again, this is a declaratory judgment action. What is being adjudged is the limited thing which was asked for. Nothing beyond it. That's the nature of the declaratory judgment. The fact that it is also a default means that under our jurisprudence, the judgment has to be read as narrowly as possible as well. So it is doubly narrow, if you will, in its reading. At the time this judgment was entered, there was no proposal to liquidate this collateral for what my client thought was less than fair market value. There was no proposal or any inkling that Mutual of New York intended to keep the surplus equity. There had been no tender of the payment and therefore no right to reconveyance, and none was in the immediate offer. None of those issues, which are the issues raised in the subsequent action, were ripe at that point. There were no facts to support any of them. There were no issues about any of them at the time. And like the Harborside case, the Second Circuit case, there's no reason to assert those claims or to worry about judgments on those claims, which nobody has any idea are actually going to be at issue. That would be contrary to the reason we have declaratory judgment actions. And in fact, that, Your Honor, is why we say this court should reverse the Court of Appeals. Because if you make that the rule of law, and we submit that as contrary to Justice Babich's own decision in ABCG, and certainly contrary to Barbie, what you do is you take a procedure, the declaratory judgment procedure, which is intended to permit people to litigate little pieces so that they don't have to litigate everything. And you're going to require them to litigate everything in every case for fear of losing the right to do so later on. The Court of Appeals said in I believe it's footnote 4. These issues, these facts which Nulph raises, were not mentioned in the declaratory judgment action. Why do we say that they were actually litigated, which is the standard? Because they arise out of a contract which was attached to the complaint. Now let's apply that principle here. Nulph's note and mortgage were attached to the complaint. There were no claims raised in this case about whether the money was there were any issues under those notes. Does this mean that Mutual of New York can never again seek to enforce its rights under that note and mortgage? The wrap note and mortgage were attached to the complaint. Bridgeview was a partner. If you apply the Court of Appeals logic, Mutual of New York has no right to enforce those documents against Bridgeview because it failed to raise all the claims which could possibly have been raised, even those which were not ripe or mature, because the document was attached to the complaint. I submit that's not the rule of law in this case, in this jurisdiction. It is certainly not the rule of law applied by the cases we cited from around the country where people brought declaratory judgment actions based on one part of a contract and then later on brought another. And perhaps I should address ABCG, because I believe this case is ruled by the triumvirate of Barbie and ABCG and Klaus. We embrace all of those decisions. We think they all support us completely.
Counsel, before you get in, and I want to listen to that, if I understand your argument, and this is what I want you to clarify, your argument, you're saying even if all of our rights were extinguished under this declaratory judgment, you're not saying that, but even if they were, and there was nothing else as far as the wrap note and the reconveyance, we still have these independent rights under 409 secured transactions. So regardless of what the trial judge did in the Court of Appeals, under 409, if I understand your argument, they can never be waived, and we have these rights regardless of what any documentation said. Have I misconstrued your argument?
I believe there is a clause in 409 which says that they cannot be waived until after default.
Okay, until after, yeah.
Okay. We did not waive these rights after the default.
So, regardless of how this court rules on the Barbian or the ABCG case, or whether or not this declaratory judgment was expansive or narrow or what it should be, you still maintain that under 409 you have these rights.
Yes.
That's what I understand.
As a debtor in a secured transaction, we do. The reason ABCG does not defeat our position in this case is that in that decision, the claims which the party sought to raise in the second litigation went to the very validity of the first claim. That is, was there a valid debt? Was it enforceable? How much was due? Did the mortgagee in that case engage in activity which should have stopped it from asserting its rights or modify the rights that it asserted? If those had gone to trial, they would have completely defeated the first action and the first judgment. Not so here. We are not saying that the finding that Nulph was in default should be overturned. They were in default. We are not saying that that they miscalculated the amount due. We are not saying that they didn't have the right to step into our shoes as payee and mortgagee under the wrap note. All of that stands. What we're saying is that once that judgment is entered, once the secured creditor takes other steps or other events happen, we have additional rights. We can tender payment and get a reconveyance. We can let them liquidate the collateral and get an accounting and get the surplus proceeds. We can object if they try to dispose of the collateral, which they got the right to dispose of in the first case, in a commercially unreasonable manner. So the claims we are asserting here, unlike in ABCG, do not undermine the initial judgment. They go beyond it. All of the things we ask for summary judgment on occur after the fact and assuming that the first judgment is in fact in place.
If I understand your argument, I'm not sure I do, did money's renegotiation with BPP, was that within its rights as a payee? I guess your answer should be no, but it was only its rights under default. Is that right?
Are you saying, did Money have the right to renegotiate the terms of the mortgage with Bridgeview? I think they did, but subject to the caveat that since this was an assignment as collateral, they have to act in a commercially reasonable manner. Because otherwise, any secured creditor could take possession of its collateral and do whatever it wanted to with it.
Regardless of a default?
Regardless of the default. These rights only make sense. They only matter when there's a default and the secured creditor has taken the collateral. That's the only time they really come into play.
So only on default can they renegotiate?
Okay, maybe I'm confused as to the question. You're talking about Money renegotiating the wrapped note and mortgage with Bridgeview. They don't have the right to do anything with Bridgeview until such time as we default and Money exercises its right as secured creditor. Once it does those things, it has rights to proceed with its collateral. It can liquidate it. It can accept the proceeds from it, the income from it, but it has to do so in accordance with Article 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code or Chapter 409 of the Wisconsin Commercial Code. Barbian says that declaratory judgments are intended for a limited purpose, to permit limited judgments, to permit limited litigation, and therefore they have to be read in a limited way. ABCG says, yes, but you can't bring subsequent claims which would completely defeat and reverse the findings and the holdings of the first judgment just because they're based on a different theory of relief. We don't disagree. Klaus versus Van Hayden says, if the claims which you're trying to raise in the second case were actually asserted in some way and actually decided in the first action, you can't bring them later on under a different theory or a different idea. We don't disagree with any of those, Your Honor.
Counsel, your time is up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You have 5 minutes to rebuttal. Mr. Olgenichik, representing Mutual Life Insurance Company of New York.
May it please the Court, I'd like to introduce Mr. Robert Charles, one of my associates who worked on this case with me. I find the arguments fascinating because I'm the only lawyer who's been in this case from day one, and there will be some light that I can shed on all of your questions as we go through this. But I would look at this case as presenting two succinct issues for this Court. Number one is it logical to extend ABCG to a declaratory judgment action and a default? And we think it is very appropriate to do that. Actually, if you look at Barbian, if you look at DePratt, which is the forefather of all these cases, and then if you look at ABCG, there are really three areas which make this case a perfect case for you to extend those rules to a declaratory judgment action rather than to distinguish it from Barbian. The first is that if you take the aptly pleading rule of ABCG, and if you take the transactional analysis rule, which was confirmed in ABCG, but which arose out of the DePratt case, and you apply those to this case, what you see is one transaction in which all of the issues involving this loan modification agreement and assignment were before Judge Mulroy in La Crosse back in 1996. That's where this whole thing arose. And what I did when I actually first gave notice to NOLP that they were in default, and then when we got no response, served them with a summons and complaint, which, by the way, the language mirrors what's in the judgment, I was putting them on notice that, you know what, your assignment has three parts to it. Number one, your assignment gives us the right to that note and mortgage. That's what you gave us. That was part of your bargain when we renegotiated this note. We wanted an extra $100,000 down. We wanted more interest, but we wanted that security. That's what we wanted. And that's what they bargained for. That's what they gave us. Now, we conditioned that assignment on two things. Number one, if they defaulted, they lost it. That's the second paragraph of that assignment. The third paragraph says, if you pay, it says, upon payment of the note, we will reconvey. Okay? Well, guess what happened? In 1996, the second default occurred. The first default was in 1993. That's when we did the loan modification agreement. Back in 96 then, when it's due again, they default again. So I say to myself, I have some options I have to look at here. If I foreclose, what's that going to get me? It's not going to get me anything because I already own both notes and mortgages, and I'm going to probably end up buying this property. So I don't want to do that. I do have a tenant, Bridgeview, who is making payments. Why don't I keep this? I'm making a good interest rate, and I'm really not in the mall management business. So what do I want to do? I want to ask the court to confirm the assignment and to get them out of the picture. That's why I use the word extinguish. That's a pretty simple word. Our briefs declare all kinds of issues about where that is. And in my opinion, and in the opinion of Judge Mulroy and Judge Gonzalez and Judge Ike, all of those rights that National Operating claims to have in this assignment were extinguished at that point.
Now, counsel, it's probably time for my question. You heard me ask opposing counsel on 409. So assuming that you have the extinguishment as you so picture it, how and what effect, if any, does 409 have? And opposing counsel talked about secure transactions. Truly, this is. There's no question. And what, in your opinion, why wouldn't this? Why would
it would not apply for this part? For the first reason is they bargained it away. They didn't waive it. They did not waive it. They bargained it away. That was part of the deal. UCC says nothing about the fact that you can't bargain away what you may have. Secondly, the surplus may or may not have been a surplus. Now, if you go back to 1993 and look at the market then and the market now, it's gone through a 360-degree cycle. And, for instance, if under the wrap note, Bridgeview, for some reason, because the market was good, paid down on the wrap note, okay, but then National Operating didn't pay down on the wrap, on the original note, we could be sitting with nothing, okay? So there was a gamble, if I could put it that way, that perhaps we weren't getting everything they said. Well, it didn't turn out that way, but my contention is that they bargained away their right to any surplus. They didn't waive it, okay? Second, go ahead.
Are you still answering his question?
I'm still answering his question.
Go ahead, please finish. I'm sorry.
Secondly, if you read the Brown versus Baker case that was cited by the appellant, it's an Alaska case that says you can't waive rights. That case goes into discussing all the rights that a creditor has. A creditor has the obligation to account, but a creditor also has the right to keep the collateral under 9505. They can keep the collateral. That's exactly what happened here. We said, we want this collateral. We want the note. We want the note. We want the $5.5 million note that you gave us. And under 505, by filing the lawsuit, we put them on notice. They didn't respond. And that's the way life is sometimes.
Counsel, are you done now?
Yes.
Okay, I want to understand this assignment a little bit better. Now I'm referring to the reconveyance paragraph, the third paragraph.
Okay.
My understanding of your understanding of this assignment is that this reconveyance paragraph remained operative up until default.
Correct.
And once default occurred, then the reconveyance paragraph was no longer operative.
That's correct. And the reason you come to that conclusion, Your Honor, is if you look at the second paragraph, the second operative paragraph, that says upon default. The third paragraph says upon payment.
Right.
They're mutually exclusive.
Well, why? Just, why didn't this paragraph appear before? Why didn't paragraph 3 appear as paragraph 2 and paragraph 2 appear as paragraph 3? Because you're saying that the order, the proper order, is assignment, then reconveyance, and then default.
The
sounds like it should be like these paragraphs should be reversed.
Well, the last two are exclusive of each other. You can't have both. If you default, you lose. If you pay, you get the note back.
Yeah.
You know why it was done that way is that's the language National Operating wanted to add to the assignment after it had been drafted.
Is that a matter of record that this was their, their drafting?
It's a matter of record that that was a discussion that was initiated by National Operating. If you look at, there's a memo in page 146 of the record of the appellant. There's a memo, I believe, from counsel for Mutual of New York, which talks about how we're going to do this.
So just so I have this clear, then, your position is that once there is default, there no longer is a right of reconveyance.
That's correct.
That, of course, is totally the opposite of your point.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the document, it's also the logical deduction that one has to make. Because if you default, you lose the note, which is, in fact, what was given as collateral. The note was what was given. We already own one note in mortgage. What we wanted was their note in mortgage, and that's what they gave us in the assignment. Now, I will...
Mr. Olejczyk, as I understand part of the argument of your opponents in this case, they seem to be concerned about the fact that your complaint attached a number of documents and incorporated those documents by reference. And the argument, as I understand it, is because those things were incorporated by reference, there was no real litigation in regard to those items. Do you have a response to that argument?
I do, Your Honor. First, I believe that it's been long established precedence in this court and in this state that attaching documents to pleadings is an acceptable practice. When you look at the way that the complaint was framed, and when you look at whether or not your rights are going to be extinguished, it would seem to me any prudent business person would probably call his lawyer and say, what does this mean? I've got this complaint. It's rather thick. It contains a lot of things that my signature is on, but tell me what this means. Okay? If you look at the pleadings in the original declaratory judgment action, rather than pleading paragraph by paragraph all of the different parts of the note, mortgage, assignment, and all that, it was simply easier to attach them as amendments. Now, the real question I think that they bring up in that argument is, did that put them on notice that those issues could have been decided in the declaratory judgment? And if you apply DePratt, if you apply Barbian, if you apply ABCG, this is one transaction. This transaction and the pleadings that were in the original declaratory judgment action did include all of these issues. And that's why I feel that it seems to me the hole in this whole issue of claim preclusion is in the area of default judgments. And that's the one area that this court hasn't sort of come full circle on. And that's why we think this particular case is a good case in which to do that. The transactional analysis basis of the law today, as was articulated by you, Justice Babich, says that if you look at all of the facts involved in one set of circumstances, you should be able to look at that and then say all of the issues arising out of that transaction were pleaded. And that's what we're contending here. In fact, if the DePratt case to me is one in which it surprised me that this court would go so far as to claim that when Mr. DePratt fell off his beam, his I-beam, and sued the wrong person under a wrong theory, that on the subsequent action he wasn't allowed to prevail. But that's what DePratt says.
Well, here's what bothers me, I think. Is it your position, and do you expect the court to write an opinion that says once you bring a declaratory judgment, then any issues you could have asked about in this transaction are deemed encompassed in this judgment, and that's the end of it?
In this context, Your Honor, if that pleading included all of the transaction that you're talking about, then I believe I would answer that question in the affirmative.
Let me give you, at least into what my mind is, a simpler kind of a transaction, since I'm not familiar with wraparounds. You have a contract. Could be a life insurance policy, could be any insurance policy, and you say, well, if there's suicide in 2 years, and this is the declaratory judgment, then the contract is or is not valid, and is the two-year suicide provision void against public policy? Okay. Well, there may be a heck of a lot of other provisions in that policy that are involved. But that's what the declaratory judgment is about. So your answer would be that, okay, if it's very limited that way, on its face limited, that's the only issue that is going to be later precluded.
I would say that what you're suggesting is what happened in Barbian, where there were two separate causes pled in the second action by Mr. and Mrs. Barbian, one of which had already been litigated and which caused Judge Moser no end of, it's kind of funny to read that case, caused him no end of concern over what was happening there. But the court said that issue of injunction was pled, and that's done. That's a raised judicata. But the other issue of damages had never been raised, okay? In this case, what we're trying to say to you very simply is the assignment here in which National Operating gave Mutual of New York the note and mortgage as additional security was extinguished, and that cuts off any further right that National Operating has to now come back and claim that they're entitled to some surplus way down the road.
Is there anything that was, any item that National Operating can raise about this transaction that would not be precluded by the declaratory judgment, or is it your view that this was broad enough to cover everything that's related to the transaction between these two people, two entities, I should say?
I would say because the relationship was so limited, and because everything was included, they are precluded from claiming anything else.
So as to this relationship,
as to this,
something else, of course, that's not
correct. If they claimed some defect in construction or some other matter.
But yep. Anything involved with this these two transactions, the original and the wraparound?
Correct.
Okay.
Now, you could have included within your complaint the request that the reconveyance be voided as well.
I could have done a lot of things that I wish I would have done differently. However, I really viewed this in the simplest form, and that is, if I ask the court to have the rights extinguished, number one, at least they're going to show up and we can argue about how we're going to get rid of this. And number two, then at least I don't have to keep coming back to court and arguing about things years later. I mean, we're talking about almost 8 years since the original loan modification agreement was entered. And that's just commercially not fair.
If your creditor is going to foreclose on a debt, and foreclosure is imminent, here they come, and they say, well, let's renegotiate. But one of the elements of the renegotiation is you give up all of your 409 rights. Is that what happened here?
That's what we contend to happen, exactly.
And is that something that's, is that something that is, good policy?
Well, in a commercial sense, and when you get into a case like this, it's a prime example. You have very competent, high-flying financiers and real estate managers working on these deals. We're not trying to protect an innocent consumer here. We're talking about seasoned commercial people who, as a benefit of a bargain, decided that they would take the chance to give away that security.
What I'm trying to do, and you hit the nail right on the head, is take this to the vacuum cleaner sales company who has a loan from Thorpe Finance, if Thorpe still exists, and I guess I don't think it does. But, take it out of this, as you say, highfalutin, and because we're talking about 409 and secured transactions, and they deal with mom and pops as well as interests like this. And that's why I even get to policy. I mean, in some ways I think, this is a contract, bargaining power, but what you're asking for, can it be applied in situations where there are secured transactions and 409 rights, where they're almost inherently unequal bargaining power? That is, we're going to foreclose, you give us all of your rights under 409. I mean, are we running into any problems with that?
Well, I believe that if you read almost all the cases cited by the appellant, they would say no. They would answer your question that they can't be bargained away. I think what's clear here, though, is that beside the bargaining away, the creditor here has to keep the collateral. Now, when you talk about one of the ways that a creditor has to deal with collateral, they can keep it. They can sell it in a commercially reasonable way, okay? Or they can make some deal out, I suppose, with the creditor, with the debtor to get it back. But if they keep it, which is what we did, we kept the note, then I think the debtor, because of the nature of this particular note, is precluded from later on coming in and saying, oh, by the way, now, after all these years, you're trying to make this deal, because anymore, but we want the money back. It's not logical based upon this judgment.
Counsel, based on the question of Justice Bradley, I just thought that if, from a policy standpoint, would you be arguing, or are you arguing, that it depends upon the, quote, sophistication of the people involved? You look at this case by case, and here you're saying, A, this was bargained away. They did it, and this is how they did it, and you've been in this transaction since its beginning. But in response, if we had to write, and we will be writing the decision, we'd have to either say that, well, it's not good public policy to allow these to be bargained away. Do we have to look at the particular footing of each of the litigants? That's what I'm concerned about.
Well, I think
how do we deal with this 409?
I think in part that's how the whole idea of the Consumer Credit Act came into being, mm-hmm. because it's a completely different set of rights and obligations that creditors and debtors have as opposed to the UCC. And now the UCC is being rewritten. So, you know, we're going through this whole thing again, but I really believe that the UCC as a commercial tool lists pretty much everything that it can do, and it's intended to deal with commercial transactions that are done between people who are, let's say, equal in terms of their ability to deal with these business decisions. The Consumer Credit Act isn't intended to do that. I think it was clearly created to be a protection for people who do not have a sophistication in the credit world. And I think that's how I would answer that question, that there is a difference.
I just want to explore that. I mean, the Ford Motor Company versus A&H Ford in Peshtigo, Wisconsin. I mean, is there inherently equal bargaining power? I mean, so my point is,
I guess I would say this: if A&H Ford was trying to purchase a set of new car lifts for their garage that had nothing to do with the Consumer Credit Act, they would be, and whether it was Joe Schmo, the lift seller, they both would be governed by the UCC. Mm-hmm. And those rights could be bargained away.
Could I ask this question, counsel? In your complaint for declaratory judgment, you seek for your client confirmation of your client's interest as primary mortgagee and holder of the note in mortgage, the wrap note, and the declaratory judgment that was issued, which I assume you drafted, mirrors that language. What's the significance of the word primary?
Well, I knew that we had the first mortgage, and I knew that there was at least one other mortgage, namely of National Operating. I did not know whether there were liens or other mortgages or other intervening liens on the property that could have been included. And that's my reason for putting it that way.
It has no significance in terms of any rights retained by the pledgor.
Well, no, we already were the primary mortgagee.
Counsel, in your standard of review, I think you indicate that it is a matter of issue preclusion and claim preclusion, if I recall that correctly. Yeah, articulating the proper standard of review for cases involving issue preclusion and claim preclusion. For claim preclusion, we do it de novo, as I understand it. Issue preclusion, arguably, it's discretionary. What's the standard of review? Which of those two should we choose in this case?
Well, I believe you should use the de novo review. I believe this is a claim preclusion case. Okay. And that's why I think it's important that this court understand the factual basis upon how this thing came down. It is a complicated case, and I'm not here to say this is simple. But what's important to realize is that you have to look at the assignment as additional consideration for the loan extension. It's no different than the extra $100,000 principal payment. It's no different than the additional interest that was requested, and there were some other conditions as well that are included in the record. Basically, that is to me the most important thing to look at is what did that assignment do? It gave us the right to the note and mortgage unconditionally, except for the fact that if they paid it off, they could get it back. If I may, I think I have a couple seconds left here. I'd also like to point out the question of the issue of tender in this case. We really strongly feel that because the tender by National Operating of its payment on this note occurred after it, not only its default, but also the judgment that was entered, that they are precluded from now claiming that they can pay off the note. That is a very important part of our argument, and I don't want the court to assume that isn't one of the key issues that we feel important in this case. The case law in this state is very clear on that issue, and because we have a case where there was not only a default, but there was a judgment putting them on issue, that the tender is no longer applicable. I think this case can be boiled down really as simple as I could boil it down for you, is to say that Mutual of New York required National Operating to execute the assignment as additional consideration for the loan extension. National Operating agreed to do that. It bargained away its note and mortgage. The assignment granted money, the full and unconditional ownership, if National Operating defaulted. And once the declaratory judgment was entered, extinguishing National Operating's rights, the assignment became complete, and money owned the note and mortgage.
How did they bargain away the 409 right at that point? Where did that go?
How did they do that?
Yes.
By giving us the assignment.
And that was
that was the agreement.
Counsel, is there anything in the court, if you should prevail here, is there anything in the Court of Appeals decision you think we should change? Could we adopt this decision without any change and just say, yep, it's right?
The only thing I might suggest is that this court perhaps clarify the court's decision and take footnotes 3 and 4 of that decision and make them part of a new decision that would apply the claim preclusion standards to a declaratory judgment where you have aptly pleaded pleadings, aptly factually pleaded pleadings, and you have a transactional analysis basis. And I believe those are footnotes that I would add. Yes, it would be footnote 3.
Can you extend those footnotes or just put them in the text?
Would I?
What was your position? You'd extend.
I would expand upon those and use that particular footnote argument to clarify what this whole claim preclusion thing is all about. There seems to be also some question about this compulsory counterclaim rule and how that might have fallen into this case. Certainly, one can counterclaim in a declaratory judgment action. There isn't anything to prevent that from happening. But I think what the compulsory counterclaim rule was suggesting, and thank you. I got
you
the red light.
Okay,
thank you.
But not much more.
Thank you. What the compulsory counterclaim rule is stating is that this court would sure like to see somebody adopt the federal rules of the counterclaims, and this court hasn't done that yet. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Foley.
Your Honor, my esteemed colleague bases his entire argument on the premise that the assignment was an absolute transfer rather than an assignment as collateral. That is contrary to the entire record in this case, whether they are the bank's people or our people. There is not one shred of evidence to support that statement. Second, there is not one shred of evidence to support the statement that National Operating waived its rights under Article 9 as part of the loan extension agreement. It doesn't say so in the agreement. There is no evidence that suggests that is the case. Third, this is not like the $100,000 which was applied to the debt and intended to be kept forever by the bank. This was an assignment as collateral. The question of whether tender was proper and permitted is answered by the Wisconsin statute, Section 409.506. Says that you can tender payment until the collateral is disposed of or until the conditions of Section 505 sub 2 are met. That Section 505 is the one that says that a secured party may choose to keep collateral, but it can only do so if it gives notice to the debtor that it is going to keep that collateral in full satisfaction of the debt, and no such notice was given here. It doesn't apply. And so tender was proper even at the late date because the secured creditor had not yet disposed of its collateral.
Counsel, the problem I see with your argument is you seem to be claiming that your rights under 409 simply can't be waived.
They cannot be waived except under the procedures specified by Chapter 409.
But doesn't the assignment here act as a waiver? I mean, if there was no assignment, clearly you would have had those rights. But in your assignment, you gave all those rights that you had as a mortgagee and a payee over to money.
First of all, we did it subject to the right to reconveyance if the debt was paid. Second, you can't implicitly waive the Chapter 409 rights. The cases we cited, the whole history of the UCC says, as a matter of policy, we're not going to let people do that. There has to be a default, and the waiver has to occur after the operative default. The operative default here is not the one that was eliminated by renegotiation of the note. We have a new agreement now. We have an accord and satisfaction. The default is what you refer to as the second default, the second time they defaulted. There is no post-default waiver of 409, even if you were to agree, even if you were to take the position that the initial assignment was such a waiver. But it doesn't say that, Your Honor. Nothing in the loan renegotiation process says that there is a waiver of those rights, and the cases we cited and the whole history of the UCC says you got to have an explicit post-default written waiver or you can't do it. And it's not just consumer transactions. Chapter 409 applies to both consumer and commercial transactions.
What would they have to do, put in including in the extinguishment or including in this that you are forever waiving or bargaining away your 409 rights? What language would you have to have?
We would have to have language that says essentially that.
Essentially.
Yes.
Is there authority in Chapter 9 to explicitly waive? I mean, where would we look to?
409-504 deals with it. And the cases that we cited in the brief. Transactional analysis. Having the claims in Case 1 and Case 2 arising out of the same set of transactions or occurrences is a necessary but insufficient condition for claim preclusion in the declaratory judgment case. Why? Because declaratory judgments are supposed to be narrow in their scope. That's their whole purpose. The fact that the same claims, that this second set of claims arise out of the same transactions is necessary, but you also have to show that the second set of claims were actually pled and actually declared. Look at the complaint in this case. None of the things we're talking about are mentioned there at all. Not at all. Look at the judgment in the declaratory judgment case. They are not mentioned at all. The only thing is the definition, the declaration that money is now the primary mortgagee. By the way, there is nothing in the record about where that language came from. But an easy interpretation of that is that National Operating was the mortgagee and payee, the only one under that note. They are now being substituted for by Mutual of New York. That's the effect of that language. That's the purpose of that language. Counsel argues that the last clause of the assignment, the last paragraph of the assignment,
You may finish your sentence, but not much more.
And the previous one are opposites, that they pertain to the only two possibilities, and that simply is not so. You have one situation, which is default, and you have one situation, which is payment. But payment can occur before or after default and is expressly authorized after default by Section 409-506 of the Wisconsin Commercial Code. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, both counsel. That concludes the hearing on 99.